The argued case is number 21-1838, Modern Font Applications against Alaska Airlines. Mr. Clegg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Perry Clegg, and I represent Appellant Modern Font Applications, who is the plaintiff in this case. On appeal, there are two primary issues I'd like to address during the hearing. First, the District Court abused its discretion and committed an error of law by not allowing Appellant's in-house attorney to have access to certain categories of information. Second, the District Court also abused its discretion and committed an error of law by maintaining confidential designations without requiring Alaska to proffer any evidence or facts to demonstrate good cause or that the information merited the designated protection. Now, before addressing the foregoing substantive issues on appeal, I would like to specifically address a case cited by Alaska for the proposition that, quote, as a general matter, discovery orders are not appealable under the collateral order doctrine, unquote. Alaska makes this assertion on page 11 of its response brief, citing a Tenth Circuit case, SEC v. Merrill Scott and Associates. However, the Merrill Scott case treated orders regarding the modification of protective orders differently than routine discovery orders and actually goes against Alaska's position. In Merrill Scott, the Tenth Circuit was specifically considering an order regarding the modification of a protective order and evaluated whether the Tenth Circuit had jurisdiction to review the order on appeal under the collateral order doctrine, also known as the Cohen doctrine. Referring to the order regarding modification of a protective order, the Tenth Circuit held, quote, we conclude we have jurisdiction to address the merits of the challenged order of the district court, unquote. And that was
Counselor, this is Judge Reyna. I'm glad you arrived to this particular point you're now addressing, because the first concern that I have with the case is, why is this even before us? Is it we're dealing with a protective order that is a standing order in that district in the Tenth Circuit, and we're dealing with the administration of that order and other issues related specifically to the order. And I understand there's some other issues here, but shouldn't the Tenth Circuit be deciding this? Why is this a question of federal patent law? Isn't this more of procedure and process before a district court?
So if I understand your question correctly, Judge Reyna, and I want to make sure that I do so that I answer it properly, you're asking why is this an issue of federal circuit precedent versus 10th Circuit precedent? And the answer to that is because each court has to determine its own jurisdiction, and I believe we cited some case law in the briefs. I'd have to dig through to find it, but where the federal circuit says that it has that its precedent applies for determining whether it takes up jurisdiction or not. So is that the question you were asking, Your Honor?
No. I think our law is pretty clear on that point. But okay. This, you brought up some issues concerning the protective orders, the scope
Correct.
Of the protective order, right? Isn't
Correct.
This more a Tenth Circuit issue than it is a question of federal patent law? I mean, I realize there's an underlying patent issue here. We're dealing with infringement. But this particular question, doesn't it deal more with the process or procedure of the district court in that circuit than it does a federal patent law?
Well, the particular issue is a U.S. Steel issue. The issue that we're addressing as a part of the protective order issue is the issue regarding whether in-house counsel can view certain categories of confidential information. And that is addressed by U.S. Steel. It's also addressed by the Tenth Circuit, citing U.S. Steel, and as you know, that U.S. Steel is commonly cited in a number of circuits. But I think that because the issue relates to the information at issue is source code issue, and that source code issue does go at some level towards, I suppose, the infringement issues. And
We'll have to wrestle with this question of our jurisdiction, but let's proceed with the merits of your argument so that we don't lose them.
Okay, great. Just to finish off on that case quickly, I'll just mention that in that case, the court in the Merrill case that was cited by Merrill Scott case cited by Alaska Airlines, the court held that the order challenged met the Cohen test or the collateral order doctrine test.
Counsel,
I will move on though to the
counsel.
Yes, sorry.
Why can't MFA simply rely on outside counsel here and appeal these issues after a final judgment?
Well, that's a good question. What happens if that happens, that the rights will be irretrievably lost because there's no way to change the loss of ability of in-house counsel to review documents and apply specialized knowledge in a later appeal? And this question was actually addressed, or a similar question in U.S. Steel. In U.S. Steel, I'll quote from the case itself. Find this. So in Alaska made this argument on page 18 of their brief. They said, quote, plaintiff has competent outside counsel and could hire outside experts, and that would reduce the risk of prejudice. That's not an exact quote. I messed it up a little bit. But in almost this exact reasoning was rejected in U.S. Steel. In that case, the court noted, quote, the CIT, or the Court of International Trade, indicated that retention of outside counsel was a reasonable way for USS to satisfy its recognized need for the requested information. Yet this court, unquote, and yet this court vacated that decision, suggesting that such reasoning, you know, did not remedy the prejudice from preventing in-house counsel from viewing the information.
Well, here the only information was the attorney's eyes only documents, which I gather from the briefs is the source code, primarily the source code. That is matters which were considered trade secrets. So it's more complex, is it not, than just whether someone is house counsel or outside counsel?
It's more complex in the sense that the house counsel here has specialized knowledge because of his background in software engineering, and also has, if you want to say, institutional knowledge specific to evaluating these patents with respect to software. And so, you know...
Well, isn't that the problem? That we're getting into the area of trade secrets, and although I gather from the record before us that nothing has been withheld from disclosure in the discovery phase, it's just that it's disclosed to outside counsel.
That's correct, but the challenge here is that in this case, the parties aren't competitors, right? And so the restriction was based on the fact in a case where the court said, acknowledged that the parties were not competitors, but yet the district court found that the in-house counsel was a competitive decision maker. And when you're looking at the issue of whether somebody is a competitive decision maker, in U.S. Steel, the definition is pretty clear that it is somebody who's involved in making decisions, and it says, quote, made in light of similar or corresponding information about a competitor, unquote. But here, they're not competitors, and there's no information that would have been about a competitor. So
well, we're talking about, again, source code, valuable trade secret, and if a particular person happens to be employed by a non-competitor who nonetheless is suing for patent infringement, once you glean the knowledge of another, the secret knowledge. It's there in your head. And isn't that what's really behind the standard rule of the circuit in which the trial is being held, of protecting trade secrets?
Well, yeah, so if you look at the case law there, a lot of it references this, the harm at issue is the harm of it inadvertently being disclosed to a competitor. But if the party's not a competitor, then where's the harm? Where is it going to be inadvertently disclosed to a competitor?
But we said more than that in U.S. Steel. We went on to say that a competitive decision-making is defined as a counsel's activities, association, relationship with the client, whether it involves counsel's advice, participation in client decisions, including pricing, product decision, that's made in light of similar or corresponding information.
If I may respond. Yes, but that is all qualified by made in light of similar corresponding information about a competitor. And so if you were to look at the decisions, both 10th Circuit and then even some of the district court decisions within the 10th Circuit, when they reference the harm, it's harm by inadvertent disclosure to a competitor. The problem here is that there's no...
Are you asking us to avoid Federal Circuit precedent in favor of 10th Circuit, which leads back to my point? Don't you belong back in the 10th Circuit on this particular issue?
No, I'm just discussing that with respect to persuasive authority, but I think the same applies here because when you look at U.S. Steel and when you look at Deutsche Bank, again, those decisions are referencing a definition that applies to competitors. Given that
your business model focuses on asserting and licensing patents, couldn't you be considered competitors vis-a-vis your patent assertion efforts?
No, and may I just quickly, my time's run out, and I'm afraid I'll lose my rebuttal time.
No, we save your rebuttal. So please proceed.
Okay, thank you. So that's a good question, Your Honor. So if you were to hold that a competitor, that somebody's a competitor by virtue of licensing, then basically to eviscerate U.S. Steel, because in every case that you had, any patent case, is going to involve settlement, and typically those are often involve settlement based on licensing. So that would essentially make every patent litigation case one in which you automatically become a competitor simply because you're trying to settle the case. And in our case, you know, we pointed in our brief, we pointed out that we are suppliers of technology. Right? Alaska is a supplier of travel. Right, and so that doesn't really create competition automatically. I mean, in that case, essentially, you force a case to become, parties to become competitors just by virtue of the litigation. But now, going back to you still just really quickly, and hopefully this addresses the question.
Are you saying that MFA will not ever have licensing negotiations with other airlines? For example, what about Allegiant Air? That Modern Font was sued by them, and they're a direct competitor of Alaska.
I suppose that's possible. They won't be suing. The situation there is that would be true of a lot of parties that engage in litigation. And here what happens is there's a treatment of in-house counsel differently than outside counsel. And outside counsel and in-house counsel, if you look at the roles here in a case like this, they're virtually identical. And so you would have to eliminate not just in-house counsel but outside counsel in almost all of these cases with this kind of a rationale.
Okay, any more questions at the moment for Mr. Clegg? Okay, we'll save your full rebuttal time. Let's hear from Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Sean Hansen for Alaska Airlines. This appeal does not satisfy the requirements of the collateral order doctrine and accordingly should be dismissed for lack of appellate jurisdiction. If the court determines that it does have jurisdiction, it should affirm the district court's challenge rulings because MFA has failed to show that there was a legal error or that any ruling was clearly erroneous. And MFA's appeal is also contrary to its own position taken earlier in this same case, and it misconstrues the case law regarding competitive decision-making. Regarding the collateral order doctrine, this appeal is clearly outside the narrow exception to the final judgment rule that the Supreme Court has established. The district court has not entered final judgment, yet MFA seeks immediate appellate review of routine procedural determinations relating to the district court's protective order and Alaska's designations of source code thereunder.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say it's not routine. Right? This House counsel has specialized knowledge and experience that would that's directly related to the licensing activities and the subject matter of the suit.
Your Honor, what is routine is the determination of whether the standard protective order should be modified and whether the source code was properly designated as attorney's eyes only information because it's a trade secret. Does that respond to
you? I don't think they challenge the fact that it's a trade secret, do they? Maybe they do. I don't think
I'll let Mr. Clegg speak for their positions on that.
Okay. Right. Let's assume it's a trade secret. And it's hard to imagine that source code is not a trade secret. So for the sake of this argument, where does that leave us?
That then brings us to the question of whether MFA's in-house counsel, on a consideration of his particularized circumstances, is properly excluded from access to that source code under the U.S. Steel case and the subsequent cases interpreting it. And our response to that is that it is proper to exclude him from counsel based on his own admissions regarding his activities that fall squarely within the description of competitive decision-making in U.S. Steel. As you can see in the appendix at pages 238 and 239, which are the declaration of the in-house counsel regarding his activities, which we submit, as described, are clearly within the scope of competitive decision-making. And I want to be careful because that declaration is confidential. I don't want to inadvertently disclose any confidential information. But in general terms, it describes his activities as being related to MFA's business of licensing. That's its only business. And in the context of this case, the interaction between MFA and Alaska relates specifically to that business of licensing. And MFA seeks to negotiate a license with my client. And in the context of licensing negotiations, these parties are in direct competition with respect to, for example, the price of a license and or the scope of a license. And
Counsel, is it your position that all in-house counsel for non-practicing entities should be excluded from accessing AEL material?
No, Your Honor. In light of U.S. Steel, it's necessary to consider the specific circumstances of each individual in-house counsel. But here there is a record developed in the district court of the activities of this in-house counsel. The magistrate judge and the district court considered that evidence and determined properly that he is involved in competitive decision-making and that, therefore, excluding him from access to attorney's eyes only information, not confidential information under the protective order, but just attorney's eyes only information, is proper.
Okay, anything else you'd like to tell us?
Yes, with regard to the merits of the appeal, two more thoughts on the collateral order doctrine, if I may. The second requirement of the collateral order doctrine is clearly not met here because the issues to be decided are inextricably linked with the merits concerning whether that specific in-house counsel is permitted to conduct MFA's infringement analysis of Alaska's source code. And MFA's concerns are explicitly about speculative future prejudice to MFA's preparation of its case on the merits. But there's no evidence in the current record showing any actual prejudice has occurred or is inevitable. And in the Richardson-Merrill case, the Supreme Court ruled that even the hardship of outright disqualification of counsel is insufficient to support jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine. And MFA is an example of the piecemeal appellate review that the second requirement of the collateral order doctrine is designed to prevent, the complete separation from the merits requirement. MFA is now, this is the second appeal that MFA has brought before final judgment in our case. It previously brought a petition for mandamus that was denied by this court in case number 21-138. And about a month ago, at the beginning of December, MFA filed another appeal of discovery rulings in a different case against the company called Duolingo, and that's in case number 22-1215. That sort of piecemeal appellate review is what the collateral order doctrine's second requirement is intended to preclude. The third requirement of the collateral order doctrine is also not met because, in fact, the only way to effectively review whether MFA is prejudiced by excluding its in-house counsel from access to source code is to proceed to a final judgment in order to evaluate the impact on the final judgment of MFA's preparation of its infringement case without this in-house counsel having access. And without seeing how its infringement case turns out, there's only speculation of potential prejudice. If cognizable prejudice were shown, for example, it could be remedied by remanding the case for further proceedings under a modified protective order that allowed MFA's counsel, in-house counsel, access to source code. So neither the second nor the third requirement of the collateral order doctrine is satisfied, and for that reason, this court should determine that it does not have jurisdiction over this appeal. If it does consider the merits, one point that is very important to consider is that MFA itself advocated for application of the District of Utah Standard Protective Order at the outset of the underlying litigation. And I'd refer you to page 218 of the appendix, which is MFA's January 31st, 2020 response to a filing by Alaska seeking to modify the Standard Protective Order, in which MFA argued to the district court that the court's, quote, Standard Protective Order is in place pursuant to DU Civ R 26-2, comma, which is sufficient for this matter, period. MFA took that position in the early part of the case in opposing a proposal by Alaska to modify the Standard Protective Order. And at that time, MFA knew that source code was going to be at issue in the case because the modification that Alaska had proposed was to include additional provisions to protect source code information.
Well, to be fair, they didn't know it would be applied to counsel who happened to be in-house rather than outside, as opposed to, for instance, technical personnel.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, because the district standard protective order does provide that in-house counsel are not eligible for access to attorney's eyes only information.
Oh, okay. That's part of the order?
Yes.
Part of the standard order?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, good. Now that's helpful.
And the district, an important further point is that the district local rule, and this is DU Civ R 26-2A2, states, quote, any party or person who believes that substantive rights are being impacted by application of the rule may immediately seek relief, close quote. In other words, any party that believes that the application of the standard protective order would impact them adversely can raise that concern with the district court and seek a modification. And that's what my client did at the outset of the case, at the time that MFA opposed modification of the standard protective order. But MFA didn't seek modification of the standard protective order until much longer, over a year into the case, when MFA brought its motion to modify the standard protective order. And for that, you can see appendix pages 109 to 111. So MFA's argument that the burden of proof should have been borne by Alaska on this issue is not correct. The district, and in fact MFA itself, argued that good cause existed for application of the standard protective order at the beginning of the case, And as a result of that, the burden was properly on MFA to establish good cause for modification of the standard protective order, which it failed to do, according to the magistrate and district judge. Regarding the arguments that MFA has made regarding financial hardship and loss of institutional knowledge, financial hardship is not a strong argument because the only, financial burden that would be subjected, that MFA would be subjected to are the ordinary burdens of litigation, that parties ordinarily hire outside counsel and experts to conduct analysis of information that is sufficiently sensitive that it's not accessible to individuals inside of a client. And there's no reason why that should be treated differently in this case just because Mr. Oliver is the only in-house counsel at MFA or possibly the only employee at MFA. In fact, that makes the concern heightened because Mr. Oliver has even greater involvement in the business activities of MFA relative to Alaska as well as to other people in which it's to whom it's seeking to sell patent licenses. The institutional knowledge that MFA argues Mr. Oliver has is not specific to Alaska Airlines. Mr. Oliver hasn't had access to our source code, and so he has no institutional knowledge regarding our source code. He has only generalized institutional knowledge regarding software engineering and the patents in suit and how MFA has analyzed them, but that is not specific to the questions presented here, and so it doesn't support the conclusion that MFA is seeking. With that, I can pause and see if there are any other questions from the panel.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Hansen? No, I hear silence. All right. I believe we have the argument. Let's hear rebuttal from Mr. Clegg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first address the issue that regarding source code. Now, they address that source code is attorney's eyes only, and there was a question whether we disputed whether some of their information was confidential. In the briefing, that is part of the briefing, because as part of the briefing, there was both arguments regarding in-house counsel access to information designated as attorney's eyes only, and also there was arguments relating to whether some of the information was confidential or was to the level of attorney's eyes only type information. And the reason for that is because Alaska didn't proffer any evidence whatsoever to demonstrate that their information was confidential. It was all based on attorney argument. There was no declarations, there was no evidence submitted by Alaska, MFA or appellant actually submitted evidence declaration to demonstrate that in a number of instances, source code is not necessarily confidential. And it's true that source code can be a trade secret, and a lot of valuable trade code is a trade secret, but there's also valuable code that's not a trade secret. And if you were to reference...
Did the court make a finding that the source code was confidential information subject to the standing protective order?
The court did, but it was based on...
So once that decision is made, isn't it up to you? Doesn't the burden shift to you to argue that no, it's not, source code is not confidential information?
Yes, and let me address that real quickly. The problem
and
with the finding...
You made that argument and lost, correct?
Well, right, but the problem with the holding was that it wasn't based on any evidence or testimony provided by Alaska. It was based on case that said that source code can be trade secret. And so here we submitted evidence, and this is on page 31, I believe, to 32 of the reply brief, and particularly looking at footnote 15, provides an example where Android, for example, is a very valuable software, but it's also publicly available. So there's source code that is certainly available that is public. And no finding was made in this instance, no evaluation regarding whether this source code was or was not. In fact, there's evidence was provided that showed that a lot of the that in parts of the software, publicly available information on the software of Alaska demonstrates that it's likely based on SDKs or software development kits that are open source and likely not confidential. So just using the term source code doesn't automatically mean everything must be confidential.
And that even was if, counsel, even if source code involves certain portions of open source code, can't that still be protected as it's used within Alaska's system?
Right, but they would have to determine, and even under the protective order, it would require that they only designate such portions as is confidential and not the entirety of it. And then just moving back from there to another thing that they addressed, which is I want to talk about the issue where they said that that MFA had advocated for a protective order. And I think that needs to be addressed because the context they're talking about is early in the case, the court had issued a order to show cause why the parties hadn't submitted a case management order, a proposed case management order. And in response to that, MFA provided information explaining that there had been delays getting a response from Alaska to the proposed order and then submitted a proposed order to the court. And then in reply to that, Alaska had submitted this proposed protective order that was super onerous. At the time...
finish your thought.
Yeah, thank you. At the time, the issue of attorney's eyes only information was not at issue. And in fact, looking at the brief, it was discussed within our brief, we explained, and I'm talking about the brief in the lower court, I think it's in appendix 32 to 33, that there was a discussion that the information at the time, the source code, was not expected by modern font applications to be designated as highly confidential or attorney's eyes only. And the order that they were proposing was very onerous around source code and actually requiring attorney's eyes only information. So source code was not specifically referenced in the existing standard protective order. And so the reference that it was sufficient was not to the case as a whole, but simply as modern font applications understood it to be at that time. And so any delay... So the motion was to modify the protective order was brought very promptly after closures by Alaska software due to the abuse of designation by Alaska by, you know, designating everything as highly confidential or a lot, you know, at least the entirety of their source code and many other documents that were produced.
Okay. Any more questions for Mr. Clegg? Okay. All right. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.